Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, September 8th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City, on today's program, Amir Ahmed Nasir. He's the author of My Islam and an author of a very fascinating article just published in Medium about how Game of Thrones explains ISIS and uprooting the consciousness behind terrorism. Interesting conversation. Pre-recorded it about an hour and a half ago. A lot to think about. I'm sure some things people will disagree with, other things people will agree with. Also on the program, President Obama reverses himself, at least temporarily, on immigration. Iran and the United States coordinating against ISIS, possibly. And President Obama announces his strategy for dealing with ISIS. Also,
we have a little look into, tomorrow's the big primary election day, at least here in New York, where Cuomo the Lesser will...
Quid pro Cuomo.
Yes. But before we get to that, before tomorrow rolls around, we have some hilarious footage that I will, give you play-by-play commentary about, and we will put it on our YouTube channel, where... Cuomo goes out of his way at a public event to just ignore Zephyr Teachout, his challenger, who's standing right in front of her trying to get his... It is hilarious. It's like high school drama, like feud behavior from Cuomo, and it is hilarious. We'll take a look at that. Also, I will discuss... we've had a lot of IMs lately about Gamergate. So I will, in the better half, discuss a little bit about what's going on.
Maybe Sam's right. I don't listen to the show sometimes because I have no idea what the hell Gamergate is.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to finding out about it.
Yeah. And that and some more stories we will get to. So, Michael.
Yes, sir.
How are you doing today?
I was sick yesterday. I don't know, man. I think the mistake that I made, and I will tell this to our audience, even though it will create a lot of material about me. So I got up on Sunday and...
All right, save it for the better half, buddy.
So anyway, I got up on Sunday and I decided I needed to go, like, I needed to do like a real workout, which I haven't done enough of. And over the summer. And I went and I took a hot yoga class. And it was like about 90-something. Yeah, I took a hot yoga class. It was like 90-something degrees yesterday. And I walked out and, I needed to be nursed back to health last night, man. I was really, really sick. My head was killing me.
Aw.
So anyway, poor baby.
Aww.
Yeah, that's right. All right, folks. After Matt has done amusing himself, we will get take a brief break, and we'll be back.
The show's about to completely change gears.
we're changing gears a little bit from my sort of minor health disturbance yesterday to the global nature of ISIS. We'll be right back with an interview with Amir Ahmed Nasir. As I say, this was pre-recorded about an hour ago. We'll be back on in about 40 seconds.
Take me under. I don't know. Imagine imagine smoking weed in the street without cops harassing. Imagine going to court with no trial. Lifestyle cruising blue Bahama waters. No welfare supporters. More conscious of the way we raise our daughters. Days are shorter, nights are colder. Feeling like life is over. These snakes strike like a cobra. The world's hot, my son got knocked. Evidently, it's elementary. They want us all gone eventually. Trooping out of state for a plate. Knowledge, if coke was cooked without the garbage, we'd all have the top dollars. Imagine everybody flashing, fashion, designer clothes, lacing your click up with diamond rolls. Your people holding dough, no parole, no rubbers. Going raw, imagine law with no undercovers. Just some thoughts for the mind. I take a glimpse into time, watch the blimp read, the world is mine.
And I rule the world.
Imagine that.
I free all my.
Welcome back. I am Michael Brooks, and joining us now is Amir Ahmed Nasir. He's a writer and author of My Islam, How Fundamentalism Stole My Mind and Doubt Freed My Soul. Also a good friend of mine. Amir, great to have you on. How are you?
Thanks for having me, Michael.
It's a pleasure. So you wrote a piece for Medium recently on ISIS and the phenomenon of ISIS and how to deal with it that I think raises a number of interesting themes that not a lot of people are talking about, or if they're talking about, they're talking about in a very problematic and simplistic way in which you are not talking about those same themes, if that makes sense. But I think that, you know, your perspective might cause some consternation among some people listening to this program. But let's start just by situating what you're talking about. The name of the piece is ISIS Isn't the Real Enemy. The Game of Thrones medieval mindset that birthed it is. What do you mean by that? And what is your broader perspective on ISIS and what it represents?
Right. So thank you for that background and for providing some context for the listeners. Here's the thing. You can really bomb ISIS out of existence, right? You can go in, you can degrade its capabilities, you can weaken it, you can disrupt it. But even then, I mean, ISIS isn't really the enemy. Because even if they got eliminated, another group like it, or more likely worse than it, could fill the vacuum very quickly, could fill the gap. Now, why is that? You see, the thing is, ISIS did not emerge out of a vacuum, right? They emerged out of an ideological, sociopolitical context that's still there. When you have Saudi, Wahhabi, so-called scholars or clerics of Islam who openly and boldly preach the destruction of the West, the destruction of the infidels, the destruction of Shiite Muslims whom they consider to be infidels, right. That's a pretty disturbing thing. I mean, some of these Saudi influential individuals are on Twitter and literally have more than 10 million followers. That's not a small number. These aren't some small, tiny minority, right? These are people who are very well established and who operate freely within the kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And so
the people who influence ISIS, not ISIS itself.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
And these are people who have created a context in which too many people, not a tiny minority, right? But I would say a large minority, have beliefs and thoughts that compel them to, if not want to join groups like ISIS, then certainly at least support ISIS materially, financially, through whatever means.
So this raises, I mean, we have a lot to get to here in the relatively short amount of time we have. But I think, you know, the themes that you just raised of that there is a strong ideological current that pushes that. You know, I was on a television panel a couple of days ago talking about this, and I said, you know, look, of course, American, U.S., Western foreign policy plays a defining role in this region. and often destructively, but also there are self-propelling ideologies, and ISIS is a classic example of something that is, you know, it's self-propelling. But oftentimes in American or European discourse, when these themes of the ideological aspects of what drives a group like ISIS or the, you know, intellectual influence of fundamentalism in a place like Saudi Arabia very, very, very quickly degenerates into just this kind of crass Islamophobia, which is not only, very problematic intellectually, actually leads to programs like surveillance of Muslims by the NYPD, as an example, and kind of really mass violations of civil liberties of a particular group. So how are you balancing identifying what you see as these real innate problems inside Islam or the Islam or Islamic certain Islamic countries with not wanting to kind of feed that bigoted and delusional discourse in the West?
Excellent question, and thank you for discerning that. I know we don't have a lot of time here to go in depth, and you know, definitely recommend that the listeners go and read the Medium piece. ISIS isn't the real enemy. The Game of Thrones medieval mindset that birthed it is.
And we'll get back to what that medieval mindset is in a moment. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's actually the thing to discern in order to be able to tell apart, you know, Muslims who are just regular people who just want to live their lives just like the rest of us. And then those who do have more of a mindset that I think poses a threat. Right. Mm-hmm. Now here's the thing to keep in mind. I don't believe out of religion. Right. That just isn't the case. Morality does not come out of holy books. The cultural environment influence on an individual's bearing of, you know, morality and conception of morality. So imagine this, Michael, if you're in a political environment, right, in which there is no conflict, let's say, with the Jewish people, in which there is actually regular existence, you're going to be more likely to go to the Quran and look at the verses that preach coexistence with the Jews, right? That preach harmony with the people of the book, correct? Mm-hmm. But if you're in a political environment that is very contentious, very heated, and involves a lot of polarizing conflict, let's say with the Jewish people, in this case, Israel, you're going to go to the Quran and then you're going to look at the verses and you're going to focus more on the verses that talk about the Jews as, you know, an enemy. The thing is, in the Muslim world, you have a similar dynamic. Yes, the world of U.S. foreign policy has created the mess that we're witnessing today in Iraq to a large degree. But even if the United States did not go in and invade, groups like ISIS, not necessarily the people that they attract from the West who are kind of jihadist wannabes and who are ignorant and who have a mindset where they just kind of want to join a gang. I'm not talking about those guys. Those aren't really motivated by an extremist, understanding of religion. I'm talking about ISIS at its core, those guys who are ideologically committed and who understand what's going on. These individuals have more of a medieval mindset. They don't accept the modern nation state. They don't accept modern standards for governance because they believe that these are man-made conceptions, that they're Western, right? And that this is a form of West-toxification of the Islamic tradition and of Muslim thought. So they hark back to, in their minds, the good old times, the ideal times, you know, back in the 7th century, when Islam had just started, right, had just emerged. They hark back to those times, and they view those times as described also in the Quran to be to represent a model which is pure, which is not West-toxified, which is not tainted by modernity or man-made conceptions, but a model that's directly been given from God. And so it's a very kind of superstitious, dogmatic, faith-based approach to really seeing the world. And they have no qualms whatsoever about taking that approach. And you know what? If a thief steals and we can prove that he stole something, let's chop off his hands. Mm-hmm. That's the punishment that the Quran demands.
So
and that's really at the core of their moral worldview.
So I understand that, and I think many people listening understand that, and I think, besides a kind of extreme, a very foolish cultural relativism, which is incidentally profoundly disrespectful of Islam and Islamic people, not to mention Chinese people or any other, I think, the only people that say, look, all conceptions of human rights are completely culturally contingent are, maybe a freshman at Vassar who's not really understanding the reading material, and a dictator who wants to justify an obscene human rights record and any lack of political accountability. I think clearly we can find certain notions of accountability and open discourse and human rights and justice. I mean, certainly in Islam, justice in all of these traditions. But I think, But the medieval mindset of this particular type of fanaticism you're talking about, I think, is very clear and very well put.
Yeah.
Now, as we talk, though, but just briefly, and then we'll get to sort of the specifics of how to potentially deal with ISIS. But I think, going back to U.S. foreign policy, Saudi Arabia practices this. Saudi Arabia does chop off people's hands for stealing. Mm-hmm. It does behead people. Saudi Arabia, along with Israel, are the core kind of fulcrums of our foreign policy in that region. In Israel, we have a problem that's obviously, the occupation and things like that have not helped anything. And then in Saudi Arabia, we're supporting this, profoundly domestically fanatical regime with a kind of real politic aspirations globally, but also funding for terrorism. And then, of course, obviously, we, funded some of these groups through the, Pakistani intelligence in the 80s. We didn't necessarily look to support the more moderate elements of the Mujahideen. So even in this kind of medieval mindset that cannot be reduced to the suffering inflicted by the invasion of Iraq, as an example, you still see foolhardy Western policy setting the context for it in some respects.
In some respects, in regards to creating a context that promotes oppression. Mm-hmm. The United States supports the regime in Saudi Arabia, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as you just described, I mean, Saudi Arabia, excuse me here, you can hear the sirens in the background.
Oh, no worries. It's grassroots radio, man.
Alrighty. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is one of the world's leading violators of human rights, especially domestically, especially against women. And as you just rightly described, Saudi Arabia practices beheadings. I mean, I think this year, if I'm not mistaken, I think the statistic is already about 20 beheadings publicly, by the way.
Right.
We're talking public beheadings. And yet, no word from the United States, right? Why? Because they're an ally. And guess what? The Saudis, they use billions of dollars in their oil wealth to fund Wahhabi inspired schools, to fund curriculums and, disseminating those curriculums around the Muslim world.
Just really quickly, Amir, would you define Wahhabi for just one moment so that term doesn't go undefined?
Thank you for that. Yeah. So Wahhabism really is a sect. I wouldn't actually call it a sect. It's an interpretation of Islam that's pretty rigid, pretty intolerant, that originates all the way back, from about a century ago when Saudi Arabia really started.
Mm-hmm.
And it began with a man who pretty much partnered with Al Saud, the founder of the modern state of Saudi Arabia, which is actually named after him. And is named after that man, right? Abdul Wahhab. And so Wahhabism flows out of his way of thinking and his way of seeing the world. And the alliance that got formed was basically, listen, you Al Sauds, you're going to have politics and let us have religion.
Right.
And so it's this weird, uncomfortable alliance that has lasted for a century, which is why there are many people in Saudi Arabia who we can consider to be modernizers. I mean, to be fair, the king of Saudi Arabia, relatively speaking, is a modernizer. He wants to grant women more rights. He wants to grant them more autonomy. But the Wahhabi establishment, which handles the religious matters, have a lot of influence. And you know, the royal family is afraid that if they push them too hard, that things might be destabilized. So here you have a Wahhabi religious establishment with a very intolerant view and understanding of Islam that even considers, like I said, Shiite Muslims, Sufi Muslims, considers them to be infidels,
yeah,
right, who are condemned to hell. These guys wield a lot of influence and have a lot of money and a lot of power. They're part of what creates this you know, self-propelling ideology. Now, before I get into that, Michael, if I may, I just want to spend about a minute here highlighting something crucial, mm-hmm. which is really this concept of the Islamic State and the issue of governance, right? If we go back a few hundred years ago, to the Islamic civilization, let's say during the time of Andalusia, or even the Ottoman Empire, by today's standards, today we have human rights, we have equality between genders, among the races, it doesn't matter what religion you have, but we believe in equal citizenship now. Like, this is the standard for governance. We've moved beyond, you know, the days when there was bigotry and sexism and all sorts of stuff. But a few hundred years ago, really, in the Islamic civilization, relatively speaking, in comparison to the rest of the world, the Islamic civilization set a pretty high standard for governance in those days. Those days, the idea of equal citizenship wasn't really there like it is right now, you know, in established democracies. So under the Ottoman Empire, for instance, you know, the Jews lived quite peacefully, and so did the Christians. They were, yes, considered second-class citizens in a way, and in those days, you know, those were the standards. But relatively speaking, they had a safe existence. They were treated well, again, for the norms of those days. When you look now, as I said, we've moved beyond that. We've evolved beyond that. And this is really where a lot of the trouble comes from, also kind of more broadly in a more mainstream way. I'm not talking here about extremism, but I'm talking about the sense of loss among many Muslims who feel that, man, crap, like the modern nation, the, you know, nation state system, you know, it's not really working for us. Democracy is not really working for us. And so why don't we go back and try to use our old system, which worked and which helped us become this glorious, you know, civilization. And so they romanticize that, and there's a real sense of loss and humiliation. And the problem is when they try to go back to those models, they don't function today, you know, because Islamic development, politically speaking, you know, when it comes to systems of government, that has been stunted because of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and World War I and then European colonialism. And then more recently, in the recent decades, authoritarian regimes, most of them backed by the West and the United States, some of them backed by Russia and have nothing to do with America. You know, because of that, there's been this successive failure, one failure after another. And there's a real crisis in Arab and Muslim consciousness in regards to how can we create a system of governance that works for us? And so they look back to the, you know, golden age, but unfortunately that system of government will no longer hold up today. The standards are much higher. We've progressed.
Right. Well, we in America are no strangers to romanticizing a historical or religious past, and the, you know, profoundly, I mean, I'm not making a direct comparison, obviously, but we have a lot of problems in our domestic politics because of that type of thinking. Before we wrap up, and I guess getting more on a kind of granular policy level here. Now, I think it's pretty clear that you support some type of military action against ISIS to, at the very least, kind of impede their progress. But more, and then on this more fundamental level, you're talking about historical consciousness and, you know, all of these sort of very complex things in flux. I guess the kind of middle terrain that I'm wondering about as a policy solution, and one that's kind of interested me the most, is, you know, do we need to think about, as an example, this might open up, you know, there's reports from the BBC that the Iranian Supreme Leader has authorized collaboration with the Revolutionary Guards in the United States to coordinate against ISIS. There's also, you know, and then there's, you know, looking at the Kurds and looking at how effectively they're fighting, and you know, I guess, is this a time to really think about if there is a military armed aspect of this, should the frame be more what groups and what local sources of resistance that we want to back versus our, you know, an air campaign, essentially?
Right. So the three points that I want to make.
Mm-hmm.
One, I think there's a lot of fatigue among Americans, and in many ways, rightly so, because of the disastrous mistakes that the Bush administration has made, right, in regards to the so-called war on terror, going and, you know, on war, spending trillions of dollars on the credit card, you know, as many critics called it. And, you know, that has affected the United States severely in the form of high unemployment and underemployment and you know, just, you know, crumbling infrastructure at home. You know, America has gone so-called nation building in Afghanistan, but is not nation building at home. So there's a lot of fatigue. And unfortunately, it was a war that was waged on a false pretext of, you know, weapons of mass destructions in Iraq, which weren't even there and, you know, were found out to be, you know, the intelligence was found out to be false and even fabricated. So keeping that in mind, that's very understandable. You know, I mean, why the hell would you want to go to war when that has just recently happened? The problem with the Bush administration, though, goes beyond that, you know, because of, you know, as we discussed before, how they sort of promoted the war initially, and there was a lot of fear-mongering and propaganda to get the American people to back it. You know, now we've gotten into a situation which is almost like, you know, the boy who cried wolf,
mm-hmm.
right? And so now when the American people are told that there is a threat that should be thwarted, they kind of go, oh, yeah, they're doing the same crap again that, you know, Bush pulled with us, and they're trying to pull it again here and go to war for whatever, you know, like BS reasons, you know, this time, and God knows what conspiracies are at play. This is the real danger that we have now. The United States, yes, you know, there are threats that can be sort of exaggerated and imagined by irresponsible people in power. But then let's also acknowledge that there are legitimate threats out there. And not just to the United States. Right now from ISIS, it's to the whole region in the Middle East.
Right.
And it's going to come to haunt Europe very soon if nothing is done. Now, in regards to what should be done, I have been extremely frustrated and disappointed with how slow Obama has been, you know, in regards to this issue. And just he's wavered way too much and has really damaged the perception of the United States abroad as a power that has capability and that can move things forward. I am, however, pleased that he has now begun assembling a coalition. I think it's very smart for him to bring European powers on board and to insist that Sunni players like Saudi Arabia, like the United Arab Emirates, come on board and be part of this coalition. America should not have to spearhead this coalition alone. Right. So this is a very smart move. That's a second point. The third point is, after assembling this coalition to go and take out ISIS, especially using American air power and ground support from the Iraqi army and the Kurds, let's go back to the mindset. Even if you bomb them, we need to drain the ideological swamp. And it's interesting that the United States wants to bring on board the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to support the coalition, either financially or through some intelligence means. But again, there is no discussion of how Saudi Arabia promotes this appalling form of religious indoctrination and ideology, and the swamp is still there. We need to also apply pressure on various governments. We need to shut down funding for extremist schools and extremist curriculums. And in the West, I mean, you know, you have a lot of funding that's coming in and that's corrupting Muslim communities. And it's a tricky business because on one hand, you want to provide freedom of belief and freedom of religion. And there are many, many, many Muslims who go to mosque who, you know, to whom, like, you know, that is a form of spiritual practice. And it's a very, you know, held in a very healthy kind of way, in a very esteemed way. But then there are mosques that do practice indoctrination. And it's challenging for me to say this because I understand that these words can be taken from me and used by anti-Muslim bigots to promote all kind of hysteria and BS, you know, against Muslims. And, you know, I'm somebody, you know, with a Muslim background and Muslim name living in the West. So I'm particularly sensitive to this. But it doesn't mean that we keep quiet and that we, you know, feel afraid, because this is really a big growing threat. And finally, just to wrap up here, the threat isn't even from ISIS, you know, conducting some kind of terrorist attack in Europe or eventually on the homeland in the United States. My real worry is that the big threat is ISIS could invade the northern border of Saudi Arabia and could actually end up getting a lot of sympathy and support from within the Saudi armed forces, because they share the ideology. They share that extremist, intolerant ideology. We've been surprised by how the Iraqi army has abandoned Mosul, which is the second biggest city in Iraq. And believe me, when you have an army that has a lot of shiny toys worth billions, but has not engaged in any kind of conventional war and doesn't necessarily have any kind of committed troops who are experienced and battle-hardened, we can see a desertion, and we can, worse, see people within that military infrastructure take the side of ISIS, and we could perhaps see the unraveling of Saudi Arabia or parts of Saudi territory. And let's keep in mind, the northern, eastern part of Saudi Arabia is where the bulk of oil facilities are, and that could create a severe disruption in the world's oil supply. Let's just keep all that in mind.
Well, a lot to think about, a lot to debate, a lot more to discuss. Amir Ahmed Nasir, he's the author of My Islam, How Fundamentalism Stole My Mind and Doubt Freed My Soul. We'll also have a link up, obviously, on the Majority Report website, majority.fm, to his new piece in Medium on ISIS and the medieval mindset, and why that medieval mindset is the real enemy, not ISIS. Amir, as always, I really appreciate your time, man. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Take care. Welcome back, folks. Interesting. I'm really curious to hear what people have to say about Amir. I mean, what I admire about him, and I should say, knowing him personally, he's also somebody who's taken some real risk in certain places that he's lived, such as the Sudan, writing what he's written and being outspoken, as he's outspoken on a lot of the issues he deals with. And I think the way he's able to kind of integrate dealing with some genuinely challenging things inside his community and inside his faith without being, without revert, because it seems like, you know, a lot of people take on those issues and then they sort of become handmaidens of Islamophobia and garbage U.S. policies. And he doesn't do that. He's really trying to thread a needle and integrate a lot of very difficult things and have difficult conversations, but in smart ways, and get to new places. So I agree or disagree, he's somebody whose work is very, very much worth following.
So Sam has been on this show talking about tomorrow's election, in which Cuomo the Lesser very well may be embarrassed, to say the least. What do you think about that, Michael Brooks?
I think he's going to be embarrassed, and I think he's already been embarrassed.
Because, see, his challenger, Zephyr Teachout, and her running mate, Tim Wu, are really sending his campaign, Andrew Cuomo's campaign, into sort of a what's the word I'm looking for?
A lame spin.
Yes. Thank you. That's much better than I was even thinking.
A pathetic spin.
To the point where, at a Labor Day parade just this past week, where many elected officials and candidates in New York, the New York City area, showed up to march in, Cuomo was getting ready to lead the march, and Zephyr Teachout happened to be right there, and she thought, you know, this might be a good time to go over to Andrew Cuomo and just say, hello, how are you? Good luck on Tuesday. And, you know, I guess if you were a grown-up, an adult, a mature adult, and you were the governor of New York, and whether or not you thought you would win or not, but especially if you thought you would win, you're going to win, you would say, let me indulge them, be a respectable human being, and say, hi, how are you? Same to you. See you around. Good luck to you, too. That didn't happen. Because what happened is much, much funnier. And this comes thanks to NewYorkTrue.com. I will give you a play-by-play because about the first 30 seconds of this minute-long clip, you really got to see it to know what's happening. There's not much audio. But then it gets really good audio-wise. You can see the clip. We'll put it up on our YouTube as part of this segment. Sam's computer's up, Michael?
Sam's computer's up.
All right, here we go.
Hi, how are you doing?
All
right, so there's Zephyr Teach Out.
Please, two steps back, everybody.
And
please,
she's now standing back, directly everybody. In front of Andrew Cuomo.
Just two steps back.
And there's this guy standing between her and Cuomo. And this, pretty sure this guy's trying to stop her from getting over to Cuomo. She goes around, and the guy shows up on the other side to block her again. Here we go. Listen to Cuomo here.
Where's Mayor Bill de Blasio? Where's the mayor when you need him? We need the mayor. Where's the mayor? Where's the mayor? Come in here.
Okay, let's go. Let's back up.
So Cuomo turned away from her. So Cuomo turns away from Zephyr Teachout after she's on one side first. This guy is clearly blocking her from getting to Cuomo. She goes around to go onto the other side to try to get to Cuomo. That guy suddenly appears there between her and Cuomo again. And then Cuomo, I guess, sensing maybe she's going to make it to me, all of a sudden turns around and just starts screaming, "Hey, where's the mayor?
Where's Bill de Blasio?
Where's Bill de Blasio?
Hickory dickory dock.
Yeah, I guess Andrew Dice.
Where's
Cuomo?
Bill de Blasio when Zephyr Teachout's on my block?"
You know exactly what he's doing. Because yes. This is one of the oldest things people do. I mean, you do this in high school when you see someone you're having drama with in the hallways and you don't want to deal with it. You do this maybe when you run into an ex or something on the train in the subways of Manhattan or something. You see someone you don't want to interact with. You quickly make a spectacle turning to somebody or someone you know, whether you really know them or not, and just be as loud as possible to make that person you don't want to interact with seem like, oh, I can't get to them. They're busy right now. Oh, hey, where's the mayor? Where's Bill de Blasio? Oh, that is just, my God. I mean, if there's just another reason.
Another, if that didn't convince you.
I mean,
you.
Of all the reasons to not like Cuomo, if you needed one more, if the Coke money wasn't enough, if the money from the Koch brothers wasn't enough, he got donations. He got money.
I don't. Is that true?
Yes, I believe that.
I mean,
sure
he's
that's
got.
True.
I mean, he certainly got plenty of plutocrat money.
I mean, if all those reasons, if the Moreland Commission wasn't enough to push you over the edge, you know, then here you go. I think this should do it.
I just
don't you at least want a governor who stands up proudly and goes, you know, and goes, "Hello, pleased to meet you." There's another video, you can go to NewYorkTrue.com and see it, where Tim Wu, at this same parade, attempts to meet with him. And he actually, I guess because that guy blocking Zephyr Teachout didn't know who Tim Wu was, because Tim Wu literally stands right in front of Cuomo, face to face. And like, there's an awkward like couple of moments where like they're just staring at each other. And Cuomo isn't sure if he should say anything. And then Tim Wu's just like, "Hi, nice to meet you. I'm Tim Wu. Good luck on Tuesday." And Cuomo is just like staring at him. And then he just like raises his hands to shake his hands, I guess, because he realizes that's the only way he's going to get.
You know, I think what's fascinating about it, though, is like, you know, to contrast, actually, and please save the IMs and the emails. This is all just optics. The contrast between Chris Christie is kind of amazing because Christie is like. Anybody, like, I mean, look, he's a bully and a schmuck, and he focuses attention on teachers and people like that. But by that same token, I just cannot picture Chris Christie not, you know, I mean, at the very least, be like, oh, it's everything. Go screw yourself, lady. Yeah, like, you don't know anything. I mean, the thing with
your last name's Peach Out. I don't know. Yeah. I already don't like you.
Yeah. I don't even, I think the thing with Cuomo That's is Christy. Like, what's really showing him is like, he's just so, I mean, and he's built this whole rep that he's like this brutal and efficient thing, and it's all come crumbling in the last year or so, right? Like,
I mean, even
and he never, and people never really had love for him, and you know, but he was relatively popular, and it's all come crumbling down because people are starting to see who he is and what he's really about, and it is amazing. He just is unable to deal.
I mean, even the thing I could think of off the top of my head, like his big crowning achievement in New York to me would be his
marriage
push
equality.
For gay marriage. Yeah, sure. Marriage equality. However, even that, though, the stories on what finally got him to do it, his wife practically begging him, my brother's gay, please, come on. I want him to...
Well, and the other big thing about Cuomo, if you want to talk about his full... You know, Ed Koch, who... I mean, Ed Koch is not exactly my favorite. But when... By any stretch of the imagination. But you know, during a race between Mario, Cuomo the better... And Andrew Cuomo, there were these signs that went around called, I think it was, I don't remember how it went, but it was like, vote for Mario, not the fag or something. And it is pretty accepted in political lore. And certainly Ed Koch thought that Andrew was behind those posters. So even there, and look, whatever, he's running a race in the early 80s, late 70s. I get it. I'm not, you know, I have my cynicism like everybody else, but I don't think that there is anything that this guy has done, including the good stuff like marriage equality or gun control, that really do. I mean, he's a very hollow politician, and he can't even shake hands. I mean, but we already knew all that.
Yeah,
we didn't know that he was so insulated and so odd that he literally could not shake hands with this person.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just weird.
It is weird.
All right, we are going to go directly to the fun half. I want to say up front, I do not really have fun half stories. This is sort of a Michael Brooks version of a Sam Cedar fun half. But Matt has some slightly fun stories. And, you know, insofar as Matt's stories can be fun. I was kidding. Folks, obviously, as Sam says every day and as we say every time we're at the mic, your memberships make this show possible. The types of conversations that we have here are obviously really unique, and the types of politics and things that we're supporting are obviously also really unique. And this is, in that old phrase that we don't really use anymore, unbought, unbossed. You're the bosses. And you can become one of our bosses by becoming a member today.
Just go to majority.fm, click the Become a Member link right up top. It just says that right there, become a member. And for less than a cheap cup of coffee a day.
Cheap cup of coffee.
Not Starbucks, cheap. Like your corner 90-cent bodega coffee. Cheaper than that. A day.
Cheaper than bodega coffee. Cheaper than your local gas station coffee if you live in a rural part of the country. Join. Become a member. That's what makes everything we do possible. And obviously you get 50 extra minutes of great content a day. And you get to feel... really just as one.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, part of the team.
That extra content is a bonus to you because basically
you're funding the whole thing.
That first half too.
You're funding the whole thing.
If it wasn't for members, there would be no free portion for anybody.
That's right.
And
without you, there's nothing.
You can also support this show in other ways, such as buying your junk through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. We had a listener just buy something pretty cool for his son, I believe.
Yep.
Something like a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And his son, 13-year-old son, reminded him to use the Majority Report link.
Brilliant kid.
If his kid at the age of 13 can remember to do that with all the things on a 13-year-old's mind, folks.
Yeah, including like about to get one of those major things that's on his mind, and he still remembers.
Then there's no excuse.
No excuse.
For you to not remember to use that link.
That's right.
You can also support this show by buying your coffee, Fair Trade Coffee and Chocolates, from justcoffee.coop. That's .coop. Use coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off your entire order. You can also support this show by, and this is doesn't cost you a dime, people. Give us a review on iTunes, please, whether you're a free listener or a member. Please go to that iTunes, our link in iTunes where our show is listed, and give us a review. Give a star review and a written feedback review. It doesn't have to be long. It could be, I love this show. As simple as that.
As simple as that.
Yes. But please give us those ratings and reviews. They help us tremendously rise in the iTunes rankings where people can discover this show. And possibly if you can't afford to become a member, these people who you help bring the show to, they can become a member maybe.
And you can join us on the Better Half, the Fun Half, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920.
And you can IM us through all the legacy IMs. I believe the main one we use now is majorityfm@jabber.org, which means you could get us at any IM program you use. What else? Is that it? We covered everything, didn't we? Sam Cedar is back tomorrow.
We will see you on the Fun Half.
We will see you on the Fun Half. We'll be right back.